Well, as Ken said, it's really gratifying to see so many people on a fine summer morning in the middle of an AGO convention willingly turn out for an hour's session on theory and keyboard skills. It's really rather amazing. Ken is correct to observe that these skills of transposition and modulation are actually really related to each other. I'm going to talk for about a half hour on the subject of modulation, and I have a few examples to play for you. But playing modulations really implies an ability to play in various keys. And of course, learning to transpose also implies the same ability. Indeed, many modulation exercises are, in reality, transposition exercises. And so if you develop your ability to play examples such as you'll find in my handout, in every key, will be really, really valuable for you to develop your ability to modulate, but also your ability to transpose. Most of us are probably aware that the real reasons to study these skills, moreover, have to do with improving our aural sense and our aural imagery, our ability to conceptualize sound, and our abilities to develop the connections between our minds and our ear and our fingers. And so there's kind of a deeper mission behind teaching these keyboard skills that really cuts to the foundation of developing our musicianship. Since a complete study of modulation theory and techniques is far beyond the limits of our time this morning, I have selected a number of ideas that I want to share with you, but they're not completely exhaustive. And the ideas I have to share for you this morning are intended to complement the excellent materials that are already available from the AGO. We have two publications that are available from AGO materials. Preparing for the AGO exams, which is a series of reprints of various articles from the American Organist. And this book contains a very fine article by Max Miller, one of Ken's mentors from New England, who is affectionately known as Uncle Max to many in the AGO, especially in New England. Also, the study guidelines for the colleague examination contain a rather comprehensive discussion of the colleague exam's modulation question that was developed by Charles S. Brown, who was formerly of North Texas State University in Denton. Both Ken and I owe a great deal of our interest in the guild and certification to these two people. Ken, you studied with Uncle Max, did you not?
For a long time, I was assistant, and he played at our book.
And although I was never formally a student of Charles Brown, when I was doing my master's degree at Southern Methodist about 30 years ago, Dr. Brown was at North Texas State, and he is actually the person that got me interested in the AGO certification program to begin with, and so I consider him one of my mentors. In these guild publications, there are a number of articles on improvising as well that contain useful ideas that are related to these subjects. And so in the handout that I gave you this morning and in my short session today, what I'd like to do is suggest not necessarily complete modulations, but rather some exercises and techniques that you can use to practice to develop your ability to modulate. I've tried to organize some of my materials in ways that contrast from the published AGO materials, so that the intention is those of you studying to develop your own skill, or those of you who are involved in teaching, might be able to expand the repertoire of methodologies that you have to use either for yourself or for your own students. In the handout, I've given you a short, very selected bibliography with a few annotations of books that I found useful to refer to for ideas, and so you have that to take with you as well. So at the beginning of my handout, I listed a few definitions of what is a modulation. From Max Miller's article and Charles Brown's materials, I lifted a couple of phrases. I don't think either of these people intended really to present a formal definition, but I thought this would be a good beginning point to consider the question of really what is a modulation in tonal music. From Max Miller's article, A First Step in Keyboard Modulation from 1982, modulating is going smoothly from one key to another. From Dr. Brown's CAGO study guide, modulation is the process by which a change of tonality is made in a smooth and convincing way. And then from the New Grove Dictionary, a more formal definition really intended as an academic definition, in tonal music, a firmly established change of key, as opposed to a passing reference to another key known as tonicization. The scale or pitch collection and characteristic harmonic progressions of the new key must be present, and there will usually be at least one cadence to the new tonic. Some considerations about these definitions. It seems to me that the key words, a convincing way, probably represent a better criterion to consider whether a modulation is successful or not. Smoothness may or may not be a necessary quality in a successful modulation. It might depend on what you consider smooth, but you probably know that in Western tonal music there are many examples of very effective modulations which might be called dramatic or abrupt or sudden, but possibly not smooth. So I think smoothness maybe is a better criterion, rather convincingness is a better criterion than smoothness. Studying and playing modulations also forces you to consider what it means to be in a key. And in fact, modulation is one of the most important characteristics of tonal harmony that defines Western music. Another reference work, the Harvard Dictionary of Music, states, quote, "The capacity for modulation, even more than the establishment of key, is the most distinctive and powerful property of the tonal system in Western music, especially since the community of 12 major and 12 minor keys was made intentionally practical by equal temperaments." That's a pretty strong statement, and so we're studying something that is really valuable but also very, very central to the nature of the kind of music that we study. So my other considerations from my first page of your handout, it's important to establish a new key clearly. Thirdly, understanding a modulation depends on the oral perception of the listener. Hence, some ambiguity is inherent in distinguishing among a mere tonicization, a false modulation, some theorists use that term as an in-between term, and a true modulation. My last consideration, and I'll have a demonstration for you, a modulation to a foreign key may be easier to accomplish than one to a diatonically related key. The ear is forced to interpret a new key quickly when there is a large change in the number of accidentals, in other words, the set of pitch classes in the keys used. This last observation is a really interesting one, and it tends to turn upside down a lot of common perceptions about key relationships. Normally, we think of closely related keys as somehow easier and less complex, but in reality, it can be more difficult to establish a modulation to a nearby key than it is one that's far away. So the four points I want to address in the remaining time: a few comments about key relationships, a few comments about organizing ways of practicing cadences in different keys, a preparatory exercise that you can use to learn to modulate to closely related keys, and then an example of a special chromatic technique that is well known, and that is the enharmonic reinterpretation of diminished seventh chords. So, I'd like to play a piece of music for you. It's a short piece, and I want you to tell me if it modulates. The starting note is G. and the starting key is G major. And could you all sing tonic for me? Here's the piece of music. Could you sing tonic again? So did that piece of music modulate? Apparently not. Everyone sang G and no one sang D. But it started in one key and ended in another key, and it moved smoothly from one key to another key, and there was a cadence in the new key.
No, it wasn't effective.
All right. Let me play the piece again, and I'm going to add a second phrase. And again, the question is, did the piece modulate? Could you sing tonic? So maybe the piece still didn't modulate. Let me play it again. Those of you that recognize this familiar harmonization of a chorale know that I transposed the second phrase of the chorale from the original key to the dominant key to try to reinforce the dominant. I went from G major to D major. I repeated an entire phrase in D major, but still we weren't completely convinced that the piece had modulated, because of course it would be very easy after that cadence to hear us get back to the original tonic. It's true with this example that I'm fixing the game a little bit by using a musical example that's probably familiar to most of you. It's a J.S. Bach harmonization of the German chorale Ermunterdich. And if you do recognize the piece, you probably had some expectations as to how it was supposed to go, and the second phrase that I played came as a little bit of a surprise. It wasn't the one that you were expecting. But as I like to say to my students at the university here, it's my game, so I can set the rules any way I like. However, there are many aspects of music that concern a listener's expectations as a part of their oral perception. Let me play two phrases for you again. And again, I'd like you to tell me if the piece modulated. Sing tonic. Some of you can sing the original tonic, but if you can sing the original tonic of G, you probably found that it took a little more effort and a little more concentration than it did the previous time. What key did I end up in? B flat minor. More about how I did that. I had thought about reproducing those musical examples for your handout, but they're such bad music that I want to be certain that no one uses them. If your oral memory is good enough that you can reproduce that on your own from your ear, you're welcome to play it. Otherwise, it's my music, and we'll let Bach roll over in his grave a few times and wish him peace. The two examples of of, I would say, tonicizing D major. I don't think the first two examples really accomplished a secure modulation of D major. And the final example where I modulated to B flat minor, by the way, via a respelling of an applied diminished seventh chord, which happened on a weak rhythmic beat and therefore goes by rather quickly. But these two examples illustrate the difference the ear experiences in interpreting different accidentals, or as I said, different sets of pitch classes. If you compare the G major scale and the D major scale to each other, how many notes are different? Just one, right? The G major scale. The D major scale. Instead of C natural, we have C sharp. Compare the G major scale to the B flat minor scale. For simplification, leave the altered tones out of the B flat minor scale. And how many notes are different? The G major scale. In a B flat minor scale, a natural minor, C natural is in both keys. And that's it. The two sets of pitch classes only have one note in common, namely C natural. And so the change in the notes that you're using forces your ear to interpret the new material more quickly. On the next page of your handout, then, I've given you a diagram that shows key relationships and closely related keys. Many theory books have diagrams similar to this one, and so this does not need a great deal of explanation, but generally, closely related keys are considered to be keys that whose key signatures differ by no more than one accidental from each other, or they can be thought of as keys whose tonic chords can be found as diatonic triads in the original key. And so the table at the top, with the first table with the arrows, shows the five different tonalities that are closely related to D major, and you can see them there with the Roman numerals. The first line of music under the table is just all of the diatonic triads in a D major scale, and so you can see that the five keys closely related to D major are E minor, F major, G major, E minor, F sharp minor, G major, A major, and B minor. And likewise, closely related keys to D minor would be F major, G minor, A minor, B flat major, and C major. It's possible to group all other key relationships together in one lump as distant or foreign, but some theorists have tried to subdivide these further. If the theory on page 2 is familiar to you and comfortable, and it's stuff that you've seen before, there's an appendix at the back of the handout that is an attempt to divide key relationships further. We won't have time to discuss it this morning, but I included that for those of you that want to explore that. On page 3, how do you establish a sense of key? How do you make it sound like you're in a key? From Dr. Brown's CAGO study guide, he writes, one needs to make a complete review of the new key by sounding all the diatonic pitches found in that tonality. And then Dr. Brown recommends learning and transposing a short chord progression like the one I printed on page 3. The example does sound all seven pitches in the key of A major, but I think that the cadence type, especially with the cadential 6-4 chord that many of us learned was called a tonic 6-4 chord, I don't know if any of you have had a theory where they've told you it's not tonic, but the function is really dominant, and there are some theory methods that do not use the Roman numeral 1 for that chord, but rather a Roman numeral 5. I think that that cadential 6-4 chord and the passing seventh at the very, very end of the cadence are probably just as important in establishing A major as the key than sounding all of the same seven pitches. And in fact, in reality, establishing keys in tonal music depends on a number of contexts. Particularly important in tonal music is the relationship between the dominant and tonic pitches and harmonies. That is, A and E, those opposing each other. And in many instances, a melodic sense of what some theorists call the key defining tritone relationship. In this key, it would be the tritone between G sharp and D natural, or scale degree 7 and scale degree 4. The tendency of scale degree 7 to resolve upwards at a cadence, and the tendency for the fourth scale degree to resolve downwards to form the major third. Listen to the example again without those elements. I'll play the same progression, but I'm not going to play the cadential 6-4 chord. I'm simply going to play dominant harmony in the next to last bar, and I'm going to leave out the passing seventh. And if you're in tune with this, you might notice that this version of the progression is slightly less convincing than the one you have on your sheets. So it's those two elements, the cadential 6-4, which is most effective on a rhythmically strong position, and that little passing seventh really, really intensify that progression. The next table is taken not directly, but owes a lot to the book I've cited in the footnote, Gary Whitlick and Deborah Martin's book, Tonal Harmony for the Keyboard. This book is probably the most Schenkerian approach to keyboard theory that you'd find. So it's good for an advanced student or if some of the basic theory is familiar to you. It's useful to be able to group chord functions in different categories and notice how they can work interchangeably from each other. And so a lot of theory instruction uses terms like predominant. Some books use the term subdominant function. Predominant might be a little bit better term to use, since subdominant implies to many of us a scale degree 4. And dominant function and tonic function. And by grouping these chords, one can practice different kinds of cadences by using different harmonies that intensify the arrival at the dominant. One can notice how some of the cadences sound stronger than each other. And so I've given a few comments here. Predominant harmonies would include a Roman numeral 4 and its inversions, Roman numeral 2, different inversions of 2-7, altered chords such as the Neapolitan chord, flat 2, augmented sixth chords. Somewhat less commonly, although it can precede the dominant, is Roman numeral 6. And then dominant functions would include the 5 chord, of course, the cadential 6-4 chord going to 5, and also the diminished leading tone chord. Applied or secondary chords, if you learned secondary dominants as secondary dominants, the terms are used interchangeably, such as dominant 7 of 5 or diminished 7 of 5 can embellish or intensify these functions. A cadential 6-4 chord will intensify the dominant if it is used in a rhythmically strong position. You might want to avoid other second inversion triads altogether, even though there are some correct types, such as passing and arpeggiated, because second inversion triads can have a strong tendency to reinforce an unintended key. And as you can see from the table, many different types of harmonies can serve as predominant chords. And so I can make up progressions that use different harmonies that still achieve the same result. I'm going to go back to everybody's favorite key. You see, I just established a sense of key without playing all seven pitches in that key. So, I can have a simple cadence progression. Like that. That has the predominant chord, the dominant chord, and the tonic chord. Or, like that. That cadence had a 2-6 chord as its predominant chord. Let me play the second one again, and I'm going to add a cadential 6-4, and notice how the effect of the cadence becomes just a little bit stronger. Let me make it a little more complicated. I'm going to add a secondary dominant before I play the 6-4 chord, and listen how this cadence becomes even stronger. One more element, and that is a seventh to the final dominant chord. Many of these progressions, then, even though they use different harmonies, are very similar to each other in how the chords function, and you may have noticed that they all used the same bass line, that is, or four to sharp four to five to one. And so this way of considering cadences suggests a way that one can practice them. I've just taken an idea that I can easily transpose to all keys, and I'll bet most of you can as well, if you just play 4-5-1 in your left hand. I can play that in C. I can play it in E flat. And then I can harmonize that bass line. And produce my cadence that way. Another way you can do this is, and it leads to slightly more complicated harmonies, is to approach the dominant note from above. That is, instead of going from 4-5, go from 6-5, and then go through the chromatic half step, back to everybody's favorite key. And so, line becomes or with a chromatic half step and you can hear that last cadence sounded considerably stronger than the previous one. I added an augmented sixth chord, a German augmented sixth chord if you want, as well as a cadential 6-4, and all of those elements really intensified the dominant. You may know if you've practiced modulating and you've gotten frustrated practicing modulating, and I'm among those people, although because for my day job I teach a bunch of graduate students how to do this, I'm often more frustrated in watching my students. A common mistake that one does in playing a modulation is to try to arrive at the tonic chord of the new key as a goal, rather than arriving at its dominant as a goal and finding ways of setting up that dominant. A common experience in playing a modulation, wherever I've started from, let's say I want to modulate from F major to C major. Very close keys. I'll get to my C major chord, and I'm not sure what to do. So I'll try a 5 chord, a G major chord, and now my ear is telling me I want to go, but that's not C major. And so there's an example of two things that we try to avoid in playing modulations. One is getting to the tonic chord too soon. Another one is using the second inversion of the wrong chord. As soon as I played that G major chord in second inversion, it really sounded like my cadence was going to G, even though some part of my brain was telling me it was supposed to go to C. And then it can be really hard for me to hear C as the goal. All right, so on to a brief preparatory exercise, and we'll stop in just a couple of minutes and take a discussion and question. The exercise I've outlined on pages 4 and 5 is largely self-explanatory, so it doesn't need a great deal of discussion. Take a major or minor triad and lead it convincingly to an authentic cadence in every key to which it belongs. And so this is sort of reversing the idea of the key relationships. If I have an F major chord, it can function as all of these different chords in these various keys. Here's an example that uses an F major chord to function as 6 in the key of A minor. I'm starting with an F major chord. At this point, I don't have any context yet. And then I play. Another example uses the F major chord to function as the dominant in B flat minor. And I've included a Neapolitan 6th chord in this progression. And also, since B flat minor is actually a change of mode, the F major triad is closely related to B flat major, but B flat minor is, of course, the parallel minor. This example illustrates a basic use of mixture. And so in playing complete modulations, this initial chord, this F major chord, of course, can be the representation of a key area. And one can expand that harmony or embellish it in some ways and then use the remaining part of the progression as the second part of a modulation. On page 5, I've listed several different ways that one can conceive of a modulation. With a pivot or common chord, this is a very well-known technique. One chord is chosen to function in both the old key and the new key. Notice that if you're modulating to closely related keys, chords that have a predominant function in the new key are the most typical and most useful. And of course, the triads that are most common are 2 and 4. But modulations can be thought of without a pivot chord. Even though after you've played the modulation, at least one harmony can be analyzed as a pivot. And one can also play modulations by creating melodies that modulate. And this last method may lend itself to hymn melodies if you harmonize melodies more easily in your playing than you harmonize bass lines. You might want to try this idea. Here's a melody that uses the opening of the hymn tune, Großer Gott, and the end of the melody modulates. And so I can play a modulation. The smoothest one, shall we say, is to A minor by harmonizing this melody. Useful books that I've encountered, and one I'd like to recommend to you is on the footnote of page 5. Alan Brings and his consortium of co-authors from Queens College, City University of New York, A New Approach to Keyboard Harmony, contains a number of examples of such melodies that modulate, and indeed also a sight singing books like the Robert Ottman Music for Sight Singing contains chapters full of melodies that modulate and are worth studying. I can see by the clock that I'm going to have very little time to talk to you about diminished seventh chords, which really need a special hour to play and discuss. If the theory so far has been relatively comfortable for you and the ideas have been relatively transparent, then take a look at the section on reinterpretation of diminished seventh chords. This is a device that is used by many classical and romantic era composers. It is a very useful device for establishing a foreign or distantly related key areas. At the bottom of page 6, under the heading for further study, I've cited 3 examples from well-known classical repertoire. We could study these. That would be a separate hour session in themselves, but I trust they're fairly well-known pieces that all use very interesting examples of texture and rhythm and dynamic to make a respelled diminished seventh chord more effective. So I hope I've given you some ideas that you can use in this rather short talk, and we've saved about 10 minutes of time for either discussion or questions. And Ken, if you'd like to join me, we'd be happy to play something further or answer any questions that you have. Yes, Katie first. Really? Yeah. Good.
And, because it was it's so easy to go over a diminished seventh into any key.
It is. Maybe I can take 3 minutes to expand on that idea further then, so that I don't just leave you with the handout. The question was actually a comment that the diminished seventh chord was one of the first things that she learned to play in chord progressions, in learning piano, I assume, and doing keyboard theory. And it was a comment that the diminished seventh chord is a very, very useful modulating tool because it's very, very easy to use to go to different keys. And so here's the illustration. A diminished seventh chord, again, in the equal tempered system, is a symmetrical group of notes. Here's one, G sharp, B, D, F. And if the chord is spelled that way, G sharp is the root, and the understanding is that the chord resolves upwards, the root resolves upwards a half step. So in a cadence like that, G sharp going to A, and of course, G sharp can also go to A and harmonize A major. But since the pitches are symmetrical in the chord, without a context, any of those 4 pitches could become the theoretical root of the chord. If you write them, you have to spell them differently. You start at whatever you think the root is and go up by thirds and adjust your accidentals so the thirds are all minor thirds. So in this chord, if I decided D would be the root, and this is similar to an example I put in your handout, then the spelling of the chord would differ. I would spell it D, F, A flat, C flat. And then I can resolve that chord to either E flat major or E flat minor. And the preparatory exercise I put in your handout is just that. Play a diminished seventh chord. This is the one that I put in the handout. Choose arbitrarily one of the 4 pitches of the chord as the root. Resolve it, and then play a cadence. And in fact, that's the exact same diminished seventh chord and position that I used to surprise you earlier when I played a phrase of Bach's harmonization of Ermunterdich and modulated to B flat minor. I took the same diminished seventh chord, I made D the root, I resolved it to an E flat major chord, and I used that E flat major chord as the subdominant harmony in B flat minor. Never do that in church. It's really tasteless music. further, but it does. I think it does illustrate an interesting point. Further questions. A gentleman on my left had a question.
Do the two of you have a strong opinion about which of these two subjects might be taught better first and second?
That's a good question. As a part-time theory teacher, it seems to me that the subjects are related enough to each other that they can be taught together. Although I think that, and Ken, tell me if you agree with this idea, I think that the study of modulation implies an understanding of certain amounts of basic functional harmony. And so in learning basic harmony, one would be learning to transpose probably before learning to modulate. Does that sound good?
I think that sounds, yeah.
That's an interesting theory pedagogy observation. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Just a sort of commentary. All of this discussion today makes a whole lot of sense to me. It seems that's kind of the way I was brought up. But when I transferred to another school in my undergraduate degree, going into a very strong mission pairing based program from lower division theory all the way up to the top, I really felt myself kind of blackballed or whatever you want to call it, because I was
My first comment is I'd love to have a cup of coffee with you after the session is over. It would be really interesting to have some group discussion about, say, the history of theory pedagogy in the last 30 years. I, too, found myself as an undergraduate in a situation where my sophomore theory teacher seemed to be telling me that a lot of what I learned from my freshman theory teacher was wrong. Because there were new ways of thinking, and I think from the early 1970s up to the last decade or so, Shankarian theory has had a very strong and very profound influence on collegiate theory pedagogy. Different approaches are not necessarily wrong, of course. They're different ways of looking at the same material. Some theory teachers I know would not ever use, for example, the Roman numeral 1 to indicate a cadential 6 forechord. And I happen to agree with that philosophy, even though I put Roman 1 in the handout, because I know that Roman 1 is what most of us would recognize and be comfortable with. But I think we know that in a cadence, such as the authentic cadences that you can read in the music in front of you, that one chord really doesn't function as tonic. It really functions as the dominant. Some people would say the delay of a dominant or the dominant about to happen. Those who have studied the history of harmony going back to the Middle Ages and Renaissance behind tonal harmony realize that the 6-4 chord originated as a suspension figure that was actually very common in cadences well before the development of tonal harmony. So that's just one small example. On the books that I've recommended to you, the two undergraduate theory texts that I put on the list, the text by Payne and Kostka and the text by Miguel Roig Francoli, offer different perspectives on the theory. I would say the Payne-Kostka approach is very, very solid, but more geared towards what I would call traditional theory teaching and theory and musicianship, whereas the Roig Francoli book probably has a more Shankarian bent. And those of you that have been exposed to some Shankarian theory in your theory classes, again, the last book on my list, one by Whitlick and Martin, you'd find to be, shall we say, the most pure doctrinaire Shankarian theory behind a keyboard harmony text. I hope I addressed your comments. we were told to begin and end on time. My watch that I set this morning says 29 minutes past 11. Any further, any final comments? Otherwise, it is our pleasure. Thank you very much for your attention this morning. Get your certification materials from the AGO and start practicing. Right.